Thank you, Tom, very much. I am delighted to be here. I had been to Nashville twice before, but I had never been to Vanderbilt, so it's for me it's a particular pleasure, not just to see old friends, but to visit a new campus. Is everybody able to hear in the back? Good, because I have some questions there to ask. No. You know, the famous question that Henry Kissinger asked, who do I call if I want to call Europe? That you can Google this question and you can find lots of people who give this in connection with speeches. It's still the question out there that haunts policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic. And I will give you the answer at the end of the talk here, so pay attention. Thanks to Dick Holbrook, I had the I had a few interesting exchanges with the great man Kissinger. I mean, not Holbrook. When he came to Bonn in the early 1990s, on the way out of town, when I was escorting Kissinger to Dusseldorf Airport, we talked a bit about NATO, and this was before I became a NATO expert. But I was surprised because his sense of NATO was as something foreign, something out there. And if somebody like Kissinger, with his experience, I mean, he was a former Secretary of State at the time, felt that way about NATO, then how much more will our next president feel that way about the EU when she or he comes into office? We are not a member of the EU. We deal with it from outside. Its deliberations are not exactly transparent, although when I was in the State Department, I did my best to help keep Washington aware of what was going on. But we have these questions. Who is it exactly that we are dealing with? Who makes the decisions? Who can deliver on any commitments that may be made? And over time, it would seem that the EU has become only more complex. And this latest reform treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, is probably going to only add to that. But you shouldn't worry if you feel confused, because most people do feel that way when they are confronted by the labyrinthine structure of Europe. Our new French president has got a few words for us. Trust Europe, he said when he spoke to Congress on about a week ago. But as I said, we're not a member. We don't have any veto on its decisions. We don't even have a say, although actually we do kibitz on the side. There's little transparency. When I was in Bonn in the early 1990s and less experienced in the ways of dealing with Congress, we had a congressional delegation there, and we sat in this big room with the country team, and we were all taking our turns briefing the members of Congress on whatever issues we were working on. And I thought I was doing a great job explaining the sort of finer points of German policy logic on a particular issue, and they cut me off. They didn't want all that. They wanted the bottom line. They wanted to know, is this good for the U.S.? That's all they cared about. Now, you know, when you're talking about the structure of the EU and all of these fine points, that may sound like an admirable quality, not to intervene too much in what Europe is deciding about itself. That is, you know, perhaps as it should be. We intervene too much in all kinds of things all over the world. And I would like to think that this was Washington at its best, its sensitivity to its partners. But I think actually it's more code for they don't care. It's too labyrinthine. It doesn't really help them get to the bottom line. Things are moving along, and they want to reach their conclusions without having this perception for what's going on. So pardon me if today I take a little time to try to give you a sense of where our European partners are coming from. So we can be, I think, a little bit more effective when we deal with them. Now, when we talk about the next administration, we're talking about something that is an election 1 year out, a new team fully on board 2 years out. So it's crystal ball gazing, which as a historian I don't like to do. But as a historian, I feel, by training, I feel like if you know where we're coming from, then you have at least as good a sense as anybody could have of where we might be going. Now, being a historian, we could go back to the very beginning, but I thought to keep this afternoon lecture, you know, under 3 hours, I should start at a point like the end of the Cold War. And what I want to talk about, just in case you didn't know what he looked like, we should talk about a couple of instances right at the beginning of things after the Cold War. The two episodes I want to talk about a little bit are the Maastricht Treaty on European Union and what was going on in the Balkans. Then in the second part of my talk, what I'd like to look at are some of the traditional areas of friction, trade, enlargement, NATO-EU relations, and then the latest, most recent little problem, Iraq. Then I will talk about how we consult today, how the State Department, the White House relates to Europe today, and then say a few words at the end about where we can expect the Europeans to be coming from in 2009 when they sit down with the next administration. I remember in the mid-1970s meeting with some European history students, and they started giving me this lecture about Europe. They said, Europe, you know, is a figment of the American imagination. It doesn't exist. And my sense was that they were invested in their specific countries and their specific national histories, and they thought that Americans just needed something to group everything together and have one course to teach Americans a little something. And so we didn't really appreciate what was the finer points of their own areas of study. But I can certainly tell you that today there is a European consciousness out there, at least among the people that I worked with for the last quarter century, the other European diplomats and bureaucrats and politicians. For most other Europeans, I mean, your average European on the street, maybe it's not quite so strong, but there are many things that they take for granted that a generation ago people wouldn't. The ability to get in their car and drive without going through border checks to their vacation. Even if they do deal with a foreign language when they get there somewhat, this at a sort of basic level, there's a sense of being in one space. I think, you know, there are some Europeans, perhaps the British, for example, who still feel perhaps a little closer to us when they sit down. We speak more or less the same language. We have a lot of experiences in common. We can relate to each other fairly easily. But the last British ambassador, not the current one, but his predecessor, used to tell his diplomats when they came to Washington, remember, you are in a foreign country. And I think the same thing was true for those of us at Embassy London. We did better if we remembered we were in a foreign country, and people did not think the same way. Now, I think Americans can relate fairly easily to Europeans if we make an effort at it. But I do think there are also many times when the Europeans sit back and think about us as people from a different planet. I wouldn't say Mars or Venus, but there is a sense. Now, if we go back to the period immediately at the end of the Cold War, there were a couple of things going on that gave Europeans their sense of themselves. Part of it is just the physical environment. And if you think of a place as being embodied in any kind of building, if you think of the symbol of the American government as being our Capitol building where Congress meets, then the Europeans, I suppose, would have to deal with the Berlaymont building. And if just a second, I'll get to the picture. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it in Brussels. It spent many years while I was there cloaked in construction wrapping because they found asbestos in it and they had to get all of that out. But if you had to pick one building that was Europe, it's this incredible large structure. I think that may help explain why Europeans don't feel really close to the EU, but there it is. What I wanted to talk about, though, was how people felt about this Maastricht Treaty, what was going on there. You know, for decades, the Europeans had this economic community that had helped bridge the differences between the arch enemies of the 19th century, the Germans and the French. But at the beginning of the 90s, they negotiated this treaty on European Union that was signed at Maastricht and then ratified and entered into force about 1992-3. And they, I know from working in the German Foreign Office that for the Germans, this was important because they felt that all aspects of public life should in some way be embraced. Now, for a German, Europe was important because, given their past with Nazi Germany, they could work inside Europe and not deal with other people as Germans. They could deal with them as Europeans. So there was a special appeal for the Germans. But in the German sort of search for a comprehensive concept, a Gesamtkonzept that sort of put everything together, they thought everything should somehow be encompassed in this treaty. They weren't insisting that it be there immediately. It could take some time. So when they put together this treaty, it had two more pillars to go with the economic one. The second was a common foreign and security policy. And the third was justice and home affairs, which in the post 9/11 world has become really quite important in US-EU relations. But the second pillar for a long time was, and still is, an important part of our relationship. And it was the part that I spent most of my time in, so I'll spend a little more time on that. For the Germans, you could write into this treaty a section that you would have a perspective for defense policy, and that was enough. You didn't have to have a defense policy. You just had to agree to the idea that sometime out there in the future you would develop a European defense policy. For a German, this didn't mean it was something anti-American, anti-NATO, but it was just necessary for the totality of what was Europe. What happened, though, when you tried to put this into effect, and my direct experience was even before Maastricht was signed, the European community was trying to reach common policies on various issues. And they would agree that in one certain area of foreign affairs, they would try to reach a common position. And one of these areas was on the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, the Helsinki process that had been launched in the 70s when Kissinger was Secretary of State. And in that area, the 12 members of the European community had agreed they would try to reach common positions. And how this worked was there would be messages sent around to European capitals by whoever was sort of chairing this activity at the time. These were European correspondents, Koroi, as we call them, in the German Foreign Office. And they would try to develop a position, but the positions would only come together at the international meetings. What would happen is in the CSCE, that time, almost 54 countries. Everybody would meet together, and they would wait while the 12 Europeans would get together and sit in a room and come up with their common position, and then go into the meeting, and one of the members, whoever was occupying the sort of presidency at the moment, would lay out the European position. And everybody else would say, well, that's, you've thought through this, you've thought a lot of what about this, what about that? And the Europeans saying, well, we've talked about that, but we've reached our position, and if you don't like it, we'll have to go have another caucus, and you can all sit outside while we caucus our way through this. And, I can tell you that although, I was sort of lucky as a German at the time, an honorary German, I got into a few of these meetings until the French found out it was there and made a complaint. Then the Americans got really sort of irritated by this, and everybody else was too. They were all sitting outside, and they couldn't change a position because then it did throw this whole process back into another loop like that. The Americans tried to deal with it by saying, okay, well, then we'll have a NATO caucus. But you had to have the NATO caucus after the EU caucus, in which case you heard the EU position before you, or at that time it was European Community position. So you had to deal with it. So we had this tendency to have a European position in certain areas of foreign policy. Not all. As the Germans were saying, there's a perspective out there, maybe eventually all, but just in some areas issues. And you really couldn't complain because everything that was agreed in the CSCE happened by consensus. So if you really wanted to block it, you could block it. But it created this tension. And just to take the story a little bit further along, in the late 1990s, when I was an American again, and at our NATO mission, we were trying to give a sense of where U.S. policy would run into real problems. And to do that, we tried to define what we called red lines. In other words, if you cross this, if you do this, we've got a problem. And one of the ideas that kicking it around among ourselves, we thought, was the idea of a European caucus at NATO. We thought this should be a red line. And we drafted a cable back to Washington that we were thinking of along these lines, and our ambassador at the time, and I won't mention which one of the ones it was, called us on it. He said, well, you can't just say this. You have to explain it in a way that will be compelling all the time. Now, he wasn't really necessarily arguing that he was for or against, but he was trying to pin us down in, I think, a very sensible way. If you're going to try to make some argument, you have to be convincing about, you have to give your logic, your reason, your rationale. What is the problem? Now, the problem, of course, is that, NATO's an alliance of sovereign states, and they've all got sort of equal status. And to my knowledge, there has not been, even to this day, a European caucus at NATO. But that doesn't mean that the Europeans wouldn't meet downtown at the Berlaymont building or somewhere else and talk among themselves about where things are. And NATO remains an alliance of sovereign countries that really do respect each other's positions pretty much. But this issue, as we'll see when I come to this later, is still out there. The other issue that I think helps understand where U.S.-EU relations are is what happened and is still going on in the breakup of Yugoslavia. You have to remember, we were in the midst of German unification. Walls were coming down across Europe. Democratic elections were being held across Eastern Europe. We were negotiating with the Soviets about what was going to happen in Germany. There was a little problem in the Gulf. And in April of 1990, there was a free election in Slovenia. And a year later, they declared, in June of 1991, they declared their independence, and the central Yugoslav government sent their tanks in. There was a little 10-day war with the Slovenes had organized themselves, and pretty clearly there was a no way the Serbs, who had to go through Croatia to get to, and the Croatians were also declaring their independence. And the Europeans came to us and they said, we can handle this. We've got the perspective, an important word, for European membership out there. We ought to be able to put this problem in a box. And they did negotiate an agreement after this 10-day war with Slovenia that the Croats and the Slovenes signed on to for a three-month freeze. They created a new entity, the European Community Monitor Mission, which still exists as the EU Monitor Mission. The little white cars with EU symbols on to drive around and sort of maintain the peace. As you know, this didn't quite work. Pretty soon you had a UN mission there with European states providing troops, trying to quell the conflict in Yugoslavia. We had a real civil war on our hands. Some Americans knew better about how to deal with this issue. They thought we should sell arms to the Croats or give them to the Croats. It was a real mess. And eventually, towards the middle of the 1990s, we found our way back to each other and we reached an agreement on how to tackle this problem that reached a conclusion in the Bosnian-Croatian case with the Dayton Accords and sending NATO troops in, where we were all in this together. But we went through this sort of formative period of European effort to deal with an issue on their own. So we have a period of, I think, a very formative period in U.S.-EU relations. Another way to try to tackle where U.S.-EU relations are coming from is to look at areas of friction. Trade is the one that often comes to mind. You can imagine at embassy meetings when the political section is coming in with something really serious and the economic section is going on about bananas, beef hormones, what sort of difficulty we have. But because European states have ceded so much of their sovereignty to the European Commission on trade issues, for years, the trade issues really were the main substance of what you might call U.S.-European Union relations. My friends in the State Department tell me today that they are quite confident they have these issues in a box. They're not spilling over and causing all kinds of problems somewhere else. We haven't reached agreement on the last trade round, but it's not really getting in the way of things. Now, if I were to look out at the future and think about where the economy is going in the next few years, I wouldn't be quite so confident that things were all under control. But I think right now the feeling is that while this is an issue, we've learned how to manage it and deal with it in a civilized transatlantic way. The other issue where there has been a certain tension, although not, you know, a hot war, is in the area of enlargement. The United States has always been an advocate of European integration since the end of the Second World War. Every new administration is sort of on trial from the European side until they commit themselves to support European integration and so on, but they all have. You can swing back and forth on the spectrum. We do have an interest, I think, in a strong European partner. There are a couple of good speeches. Dan Fried gave one in Berlin earlier this year. It's a good sort of Tour d'Horizon, which comes out just very strongly. Dan is the Assistant Secretary for European Affairs, asserting how much we still want a strong Europe. But the Europeans themselves are not quite so quick to move in this direction. Now, of course, the countries that weren't in these European structures have almost unanimously been strongly motivated to move in that direction. There's some exceptions. Clearly, parts of Yugoslavia would have preferred to have gotten engaged in a civil war than to have been the first to join the EU, which it seems to me they clearly could have been. Norway has opted not to get sucked into the EU right away. But when you talk about the countries that are in the EU now, or even the countries, the original 12, the sentiment hasn't been so unanimous for this expansion. Part of it you still see out there when they worry about too many members and how do you make decisions. And not surprisingly, there are a few of the major powers who sort of think if they sort of talk among themselves quietly, they can steer things. The British and the... I think the British have always tried to prefer to work with smaller groups. The Germans and the French have seen themselves as the motor of driving Europe. Other major countries like Italy and Spain want to take a leading role. Poland is a new country, but still a major country wants to have a say. And one of the things that has driven the Europeans to try to find a way out of the constitutional impasse, which has provisions up for up to 27 members, which is where they are now, and doesn't have for anything more, is exactly that problem. But there's the feeling that if you have 27 commissioners, if you have, it's just too big to work. So there is a certain tension there, and it's not just in the future about Turkey. You might say Turkey is sort of a special case, but there are other countries out there that wouldn't mind being in Europe. What about Georgia? What about Ukraine? What is the position there? This American administration has said we support the broadest possible European enlargement. And that means the subtext there is Ukraine and Georgia. If they're, you know, if they're ready, then they have to meet the criteria. But the U.S. position is there's a tension there in the U.S. universities. And it's one of the reasons that the United States has been so forward-leaning on NATO enlargement, because it sort of keeps that position out there ahead of the EU position. There's been a similar range of views, I think you could say, on NATO-EU relations. As I've already said, I think the U.S. has been a genuinely strong supporter for the Europeans playing a greater role in security and defense issues. I think we feel, and Congress makes any administration feel that way, that we shouldn't be carrying the burden for the whole world. But there's a cool map that sort of enlarges as Europe goes along. But there are tensions that are in this relationship, and they're not just those that come from this consultation round. The historic area where this exists is in defense planning, and it's there primarily because the French withdrew from NATO's integrated military structure. And what this means is defense planning is the exercise that NATO allies go through in trying to look at the threat or the security situation in the world and decide what kind of military forces they will need to meet that threat. Now, as you can imagine, the process of developing a new fighter aircraft, or any other complex weapon system takes time. So you're trying to say, what do we see is going to be the threat? What kind of capabilities do our weapon systems need to have to meet that threat? It is a process of dialogue among the NATO allies. At the end of it, it defines capabilities that are needed. It is not saying you have to buy a U.S. jet or a French jet, for that matter, just that you need to buy a jet with this kind of capabilities. But for all that, it has been a process that the French found intrusive in terms of their own structure. So that has been the area where they have been most resistant. So that, as we'll see in a minute, is an area where, as the EU develops, you have tensions working. Another area that is related to this is in the actual process of developing these armaments. NATO has an assistant secretary general and has a structure of conference of national armaments directors who meet to try to discuss how you would actually put together these weapon systems. It's actually a fairly informal process, and it's been one where members have participated as they decide that they want to be involved. The latest project is a C-17 purchase consortium. As European countries have become more involved in peace support operations around the world, they've needed to have transport to get there. What they found they've had to do is they either have to get it from us, which is expensive, or they have to lease planes from big transport planes from the Russians or the Ukrainians, who have some of the old Russian Antonovs. This is fairly embarrassing. There's been an effort led by the Germans to try to get a European purchase of Airbus model things, but really the easiest way is to lease US C-17. So there's been a project that's done some of this. Now, this isn't designing something from the ground up. It's a fairly low-tech process, but just being out there, it impinges on a potential for European countries to work together and develop something. And as the EU has developed its capabilities in this area, one of the things that is established is a European Defense Agency. Now, I don't want to walk you through all of the detail of this, or more of you will leave. You will have the, but the first director was a Brit, Nick Whitney, and he tried to shape this process, this European process, in a way that would not impinge on this NATO process. But you can see out there you've got tensions. Part of this goes back to a sense, I think, of the role of governments in fostering industry and technological development. The Europeans have shown that they put their mind to it. They can compete with us in developing modern aircraft. So there is a field of force, a tension out there in this area. The third area where NATO-EU tensions exist is in the area of operational planning. When we got to the in the late 1990s, the British had developed a very clever theology, which would allow the Europeans, if NATO was not engaged in the United States, by that they mean the United States not engaged, you would have a possibility for European action using European forces which were all committed to NATO. But these could be sort of sublet by NATO to an organization called the Western European Union. It's probably something you've all forgot about, but even before the NATO treaty, there was a treaty that was signed in Brussels in 1948 by the European allies, which provided for a common defense commitment. And in this, the organization that went with this Brussels Treaty was the Western European Union. So the idea was that NATO could talk to the Western European Union and make these arrangements for lending forces and capabilities, and the EU could give direction to the Western European Union, and that way, cleverly, NATO and the EU would never have to talk to each other. Now, this was really too clever for the United States and some of our people in the European, in the Clinton administration, who thought there's no reason that NATO and the EU shouldn't be talking to each other. I mean, we were involved in things in the Balkans together. You know, why shouldn't we get beyond that? And I would like to report that, you know, all is well, but, you know, I mentioned this speech by Dan Fried from May 9th. Let me just read you quickly a section of what he says. He says, "And we must do away with rivalries that have kept our best instruments from working together. The inability of the European Union and NATO to work together is no longer just a nuisance." That must have been what it was in my day. "It costs lives and threatens our success where we cannot afford failure. I hope that at the end of the current American administration, we can resolve to put aside institutional theology in favor of integrated effort. Can we agree, for example, on the following? Total unrestricted cooperation on the ground between EU and NATO operations and activities. Our principles should be transparency, coordination, integrated action, not institutional separation. Greater strategic coordination among NATO and European leaders. After all, 21 countries are in both organizations." I mean, what they've tried to do is they've tried to have meetings where, you know, they just all sort of get in the same room, ignoring the fact that some are not in NATO, some are not in the EU. And even invite countries like Switzerland, which is neither, and just say, you know, can we just get on with the business? And the Europeans have given us a little trouble on that. He says, "Can we support Javier Solana, who's the EU high rep in this area, and Jaap de Hoop Scheffer leading this effort, instead of imposing limits on them? And finally, we need regular, practical coordination between NATO and EU staffs in Brussels, and not, please, under cover of darkness." This is what they do. They sort of sneak around quiet, these NATO and EU staffers, but as an authorized activity by both organizations. So, you know, I would like to say that this is history, but it's still very much with us. This is NATO headquarters at the top. It looks very much like an American high school, and this is another view of the Berlaymont building. The NATO headquarters was thrown up in 3 months in the 60s when de Gaulle kicked NATO out, and they used all kinds of chemicals to dry the concrete, and the chemicals have been eating away at the reinforcing rods, and so they're going to build a new NATO headquarters at some point. But anyway, we have a lot of excitement. Of course, I shouldn't get beyond NATO and EU tensions without making some mention of Iraq. It seems to me, you know, there was an effort at the time of the Iraq War to portray this as an American versus a European issue. And, of course, since I was in Britain, the British sort of took some issue to that, but, of course, not all British. What it seems to me that argument, though, misses the point, because Iraq was divisive in the United States, as it was in Britain and as it was elsewhere. And there were some European countries like Poland and Denmark and Britain and a number more that I could mention that did go along with this effort. But what it does seem to me that happened in Iraq is we did have the biggest political difference that we've ever had in this post-Second World War era of fairly strong transatlantic relations. It's not the only one we've had. Probably won't be the last. My impression has been that in terms of the working relationships between governments, we have gotten beyond that. When the Bush administration got reelected, the very next day, President Bush made it a priority to rebuild relations. His people who work with him told me that was his idea. They didn't put that in his head. It was came from the top. And they have followed up with it. And my impression is diplomats are getting on with business. And you can see that in these remarks of these speeches. They feel good about that. But I don't think they have recognized that there still is, or maybe they do, there still is a deep problem in European publics about working with the United States. You'll see these speeches and they cite the very positive attitudes towards transatlantic cooperation on both sides. It's, you know, in the 70-80%. And you find about 4% who don't want stronger relations. But I think, having said that aside, and maybe it's something that will pass with this administration and a new one comes in. But I think one should not underestimate the issue we have to overcome here. And by the same token, I think the Europeans should not recognize that they've left a certain political legacy. It's stronger for people who have just come of age in this process, for whom Iraq was the formative political experience. And when I gave talks in the UK, I would often say, okay, imagine yourself a college student in 1939. What's the big issue? In 1949, 59, 69, 79. I mean, you quickly have a sense that, you know, you could have grown up in this era, and then 20 years later, 30 years later, the world looks very different. But if you're right now, this is the world you know, and this is what you see it is. You know, my own view is we're going to have to learn, if we're not dealing in a total black and white world like the Cold War, where, you know, you have to be very clear about what size you are. There will be political differences, but we'll have to develop a way to learn how to manage these. I'm probably getting ahead of myself here. So how do the U.S. And the EU consult today? At the beginning of the Bush administration, we went down to one summit a year. This was not really something that the Bush administration came in feeling strongly one way for or against. I think this was a bureaucracy's conclusion. And I think it was just summits couldn't keep up. There was not, in 6 months, it's not enough time to turn over major issues that you bring to the attention of the presidents or the leaders. It just is too fast. But as I've already indicated, in the second term, the Bush administration has made a real effort to try to reinvigorate a dialogue, and a dialogue with the instruments of the European Union. Now, you probably recognize the two people with the president there, as the president of the European Commission and the president, the current president at the beginning of this year, of the European Council, which is the body of the heads of state and government, Angela Merkel. So there are annual summits, and these have a mandate from the president to be something of real substance and a real importance. You also have ministerials. These are also supposed to happen on an annual basis, but I think they've in fact gotten beyond that. I would say U.S. and European foreign ministers get together probably four times a year, and this administration has made a priority to try to have strategic discussions in those. There are also senior level meetings. These had been something that had been conducted just by our Undersecretary for Economic Affairs. When Nick Burns came in with his high levels of energy, he plunged back into that. He ran into the same sort of frustration that you sometimes do with these European meetings, not really getting somewhere, but he's kept at it. So these meetings occur on a regular basis. Our Assistant Secretary for European Affairs will meet at the beginning of each presidency with the European political directors. They have an informal meeting. It's usually in the country that has the presidency. They have their own sessions, and when they're finished, then the European Assistant Secretary will sit down with the Troika, and then he will meet with all of them for a session that ranges over a broad range of issues. We have, in addition to that, we have Washington sends out a cable before each European foreign ministers meeting, laying out our views on everything. Those were one of the things I would do when I was at our Embassy of London, go through and walk through those. We have a weekly phone call by the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Europe, who does your things with the Presidency Embassy, reviewing them. I mean, there's an intense dialogue that goes on today. Now, what's going to happen with this dialogue in 2009 is going to change. According to the Lisbon Treaty, there's going to be instead of a six-month rotation of the Council Presidency, they're going to choose a council president who will serve for 2.5 years. Who will this be? I think the Europeans want to have a politician of real stature, a political figure who can speak for Europe at that level. Some people occurred to me right off the top of my head who might be possibilities. Tony Blair is looking for a job. He would certainly be somebody who would have name recognition in the United States if they were to pick him. He has some of the baggage that any British prime minister would have in Europe, but he was, pro-European, at least by his own lights, but certainly I think in a real way he was. For the British, somebody who was really committed to the European project. I know you all know who that other person is, but he is a Luxembourg politician who has a strong and long credentials, and somebody who, has used his position to be very effective in European affairs, Jean-Claude Juncker. So there's, I think the Europeans are going to be looking for somebody out there who would be an interlocutor for the next American president. Wouldn't be the only person. You'd still have a commission president, a new Barroso, and in 2009, the Europeans should select a new one. So one of the people that a new administration would deal with is whoever the new president is. You go down a level, they have even more ambitious plans, and that is to take the person who's responsible for CFSP, the CFSP high rep, who is also the Secretary General of the European Council, that's the body of heads of government, and combine that position with the Commissioner for External Relations, who has at his command this very large Directorate General, a large budget, lots of money, and really create a European foreign minister. The person who has been foreseen for this is Javier Solana. He will have been in the position for a long time. Before that, of course, he was a NATO Secretary General, so somebody that everybody knows very well, and he would certainly be. That gives you an idea. We're getting close to that one phone call. Who you talk to when you talk to Europe. Okay, what can we expect? The Europeans are going to want. I think, although I've stressed that you can't generalize about who Europeans are, I do think everybody in Europe wants their voice to be heard. They want a stronger voice. And that isn't necessarily a zero-sum game for us. I don't think it means that they're looking for us to be any less. Europeans are also engaged in the world. I think if you had said to Europeans in 1992, you're going to have troops in Afghanistan in a decade, they would have thought, no. Europeans at the end of the Cold War were looking very inward. They wanted to deal with their own problems. Europeans are engaged today all over the world. They're not as engaged, perhaps, as we would like, but they are out there. And I think, we should honor that, encourage more of it. I think they are going to want to put a real premium on collegiality from our point of view. They, you know, when we talk to ourselves, we talk about American leadership. You can run through all of our presidential candidates, all the parties. They talk about presidential leadership. Maybe we say that to ourselves to convince ourselves why we should put this effort into the world. Maybe it's a legacy of our time of isolationism. But I think in today's world, we should perhaps look for a different way to express that. I don't think the United States, as big as we are, as strong as our economy is, with our military forces and capabilities, which nobody else is anywhere near, we really don't need to be insecure about our place in the world or what we do. But what we ought to do is we ought to encourage others who are willing to get out there and lead to do that. And we have done that on Iran. You know, after the Iraq War, when our relations with Europe were pretty much in shambles, the British, French, and Germans got together and said, we've got to find a way out of this dead-end street on the Iran nuclear thing. And it took the Bush administration a little while, but they eventually decided, you know, if the Europeans are going to commit themselves and get out there in front of leadership, and we get behind them, you know, we've, in fact, pushed them further, perhaps, than they might go if they weren't sure they had our support. And we've helped start creating the kind of pressure on Iran that might get the Iranians to do this. So we've done that in that area. We work, as I think I've indicated already, this administration is working very collegially. But for a new administration to come in, I think it's important that they not get off on the wrong foot and start telling the Europeans where we're going to go here, where we're going to go there, but to encourage them to show leadership in areas. I think, besides Iran, another area that they could do that is in the Balkans. The perspective for European membership is still, I think, the best motivation we have out there to get Serbs and Kosovar Albanians to try to reach some sort of settlement, to try to keep the rest of the Western Balkans on track towards integration in the institutions of Europe and NATO. So I think we should do it. I think we need to portray ourselves as the responsible world citizen. And I think one of the areas that Europeans will be looking for us to offer some signals or is in climate change. Now, the Bush administration, if you read some of the latest texts, has moving in that direction, but I think it'll be important for that new American administration, that new American president, whoever she or he is, to, in those first days, to set a direction that will communicate to the rest of the world where we are. I think the other area where we have a real deficit with European publics is in the Middle East with regards specifically to Israel and Palestine. Now, the problems there are very hard to solve. I really think the Bush administration has been trying to deal with a difficult situation. But it started off on a foot of saying, you know, the Clinton administration made the best effort anybody can imagine. Let's step back from this and let the situation sort itself out a bit. That unfortunately didn't prove to be a very successful strategy. And then layered on all of these other issues, it's, I think, put us in a position where we are in reality, but I think it's an important one that a new European leadership is going to look for an American position on. The other thing I think, and I've already sort of indicated this, is we ought to give the Europeans credit for what they're doing in Afghanistan. Sarkozy has already indicated, to some extent, willingness of the French to step up. the way NATO has itself organized in Afghanistan right now, the brunt of the fighting, the difficulty, the dangerous part of it is being borne by the United States, Britain, Canada, and the Netherlands. So, you know, a little bit broader European engagement would help. I think, you know, we might find it more effective to get to various European publics by working with national governments. But I don't really foresee the kind of division of labor where the U.S. does all the fighting and Europe does all the nation building, the hard power, soft power, that sort of thing. I think that kind of division of labor is not what you need. But I do think just because we do face a lot of issues, we should perhaps consider ways in which we can profile the strong efforts of everybody else. So to come back at the end to where I was at the beginning, the French president speaking before Congress, where he's going to say the things that he really wants to get across to the American government, says that France, under his leadership, is prepared to lead Europe towards shouldering a greater share of defense. That's something that we'd love to hear. And he goes on to say that France would resume a full role in NATO if it can be more successful at getting Europe to build this defense. Now this, you know, the people like myself who've been trained in reading between the fine lines of these, there's uncertainty in what is meant by that. You know, is this, are we going to rebuild, are we going to build a European defense that's outside NATO, that is not consistent with NATO? At the end of the Clinton administration, Secretary Cohen at the informal NATO ministerial in Birmingham offered a kind of deal where NATO people and EU people would meet at the same time, and when the EU things were discussed, the NATO people would keep their mouths shut and not say anything, but just listen, and vice versa. And he thought the transparency would be enough of a guarantee that these defense planning processes would not go forward. The French didn't take it. Some Frenchmen said to me afterwards, maybe we should have. We're in a period now where this definition is going to go on. I really commend you this Sarkozy speech. What he said is very hopeful. The administration is not going to push. They're going to let the French define for themselves how they want to move back. The last time this was tried with Chirac, he got maneuvered into a situation, I think perhaps within his own government, where he couldn't make the move back to an inner movement of NATO. I think, you know, we've got sounds from Sarkozy that he's going to find a way to move that forward. I think we could perhaps, in the next administration, should think of ways that they could be creative and more helpful. Because, as I said, I think we don't need to be insecure about where we are in the world. The American hegemony is something that exists for people who want to create concern about where we are in the world. When you look at the world's problem today from an American perspective, you see problems that are beyond our capabilities. Other countries look at us and they see our capabilities and think we're so able to do things, but we can't do all these things. The Bush administration has been criticized for bilateralism, working problems with countries as far as they're prepared to go. But, of course, the whole premise of this European effort is when NATO is not engaged, in other words, when the United States is not willing, the European project is a coalition of the willing, if you will. And my own feeling, after been through what I've been through with Iraq and Bosnia, is the lesson that we all need to learn is you can't succeed unless we are together in some way. That doesn't mean that you might not have some group of countries that are engaged and particularly in dealing with one problem. But if the rest of us are not supportive, at the end of the day, the people that you're dealing with are going to find ways of driving fissures in between us. We need to stick together. I just read a book about Churchill coming to Washington right after Pearl Harbor to try to get this grand alliance going. And it's amazing, the suspicion on both sides. Our Secretary of State was incensed when the Free French took from Vichy, France, two little islands off Canada, and wanted the British to beat on. That was his focus in this meeting. He was concerned about British imperial trade preferences. It took a while for both sides there to get their minds around the common enemy that they both had to face. It was going to require some compromises. You read about that, and even though Churchill and Roosevelt hit it off pretty well, although Roosevelt was upset that Churchill didn't remember meeting him at the end of the First World War when Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. But if you look at that episode, and then you look at the way world leaders deal with each other today, weekly video conferences, frequent telephone calls, Jack Straw and Colin Powell were on the phone. One day I was in Straw's office and he said, well, you know, they've talked five times today. They emailed each other all the time. And I don't think it stopped with Jack Straw. The world leaders today have a rapport with each other that I think people haven't realized what's changed about the way they deal with each other. And because they do find that they are in the same boat with each other. If I had to say, where do we have to fix things, it's everybody else. Parliaments need to get together. Journalists need to get together. Journalists like to portray their little world as the complete world, but there are other little complete journalistic worlds out there. And there is some echo back and forth, but I personally think world leaders are stealing a march on us. And I think, you know, state departments and foreign ministries need to get linked up. And there is more of that. There is much more direct contact within Europe, and there's starting to be some of that elsewhere. Where does that leave embassies? There's still things that embassies can do that others don't. But I think we are moving into a world where there are many more opportunities to cooperate. But I still feel the challenges that are out there are greater than our capabilities can handle. So if I had to leave you a thought, when we face this with Europe, who are our key partners still in the world, we have to go in it with that kind of attitude, and we have to recognize that they want to be treated more as an equal partner. I think many of the Europeans have gotten over their feelings of inferiority. I certainly think Blair's Britain felt like they were there. They weren't just punching above their weight. They were, in fact, a real player. And, you know, I think there's plenty of scope out there for that. So that's the that's what I see us getting into in 2009. And if you have any specific questions about the WEU or any of these other specific areas, I'd be glad to take those.